Hello and welcome to another episode here at the Damage Report. It's Thursday. We are nearly closed out on an insane week, and it's about to get even insaner and unfortunately darker as we roll day by day into this dark winter. But we do have one thing that's not dark at all. It's actually looking pretty good for us, and that is our co-host for this show. The first time ever on the Damage Report, Evelina Sabrina, YouTube creator. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Good morning. Thursday morning. How are we?
I'm doing good. I can't necessarily speak for the audience, but feel free to let us know. Those of you who are watching, whether on Twitch or on YouTube, feel free to send us comments and all of that. Tell us a little bit about your work before we get on into the news.
Hi, well, I make YouTube videos, normally comedy sketches and political commentary videos as well. And now I am streaming on Twitch where, you know, we play video games from time to time, but we also like to cover political news as well.
Exactly, exactly. And for people who are really familiar with the network, you might have already seen Sabrina on Common Room and Game Night, if I remember correctly. You've been on both, right?
Yep.
Have you been on Happy Half Hour?
Not yet.
Okay, that's definitely coming. Not that it's okay. Up to me. But anyway, but we've had a lot of fun. If I remember correctly, I think I killed Sabrina in a pack of about 5 people and got away with it. So that was a highlight of my year.
You just had to remind me. You just had to remind me.
Okay. I don't know how they didn't get me. But anyway, we've got lots of big news that we're going to be talking about today on the show, including the status of the Kraken, Melania Trump, Rudy Giuliani, and his monkey antibodies. We're going to give you a little bit of footage from our interview yesterday with Senator Bernie Sanders, which was a lot of fun. And Senator Dianne Feinstein, how is she doing? We're going to give you an update a little bit later on. And if there's time, and there might not be time, but if there is time, we're going to talk about a COVID related invention that I have an issue with. So perhaps we'll get to that. For now though, for all of you who are watching, please hit the like button and share the stream so that people know we're live and they can join in on the conversation. And we will of course, as always, be responding to your tweets and comments and super chats and all of that as we go. With that said, Sabrina, you want to jump into this thing?
Let's do it.
Okay. The Kraken was never really released, if it ever existed. But if it did, it's dead now, because some of the independent legal challenges to the election, those that are not like formally a part of Donald Trump's legal team, people like Sidney Powell who worked with him, but then they said that they didn't. It's weird. She has lost her final lawsuit, I think. This is Sidney Powell. And last night, a judge in Wisconsin dismissed her fourth and final lawsuit. Because in addition to the more than 50 lawsuits that the Trump legal team has been involved in, her, this like independent lawyer who has nothing to do with anything, has waged multiple legal battles across the country. But that might be done. The judge had this to say: federal judges do not appoint the president in this country. One wonders why the plaintiffs came to federal court and asked a federal judge to do so. After a week of sometimes odd and often harried litigation, the court is no closer to answering the why. But this federal court has no authority or jurisdiction to grant the relief the remaining plaintiffs seek. So we're going to give you a little bit more information in a couple of minutes about some of the issues with that lawsuit. But Sabrina, I don't know how much you've been following Sidney Powell, but like you do political work, but as somewhat of an outsider to this, what do you make of the fact that we're like in week 6 of these challenges, none of which seem to have any merit?
Well, I mean, you can file a lawsuit for pretty much anything, right? Doesn't necessarily mean that you're gonna make it. I'm kind of surprised you said it was the fourth time.
For her, this is the fourth lawsuit that's been thrown out.
How many have been total, you know?
I think Donald Trump, and Giuliani, I think they won one, and I stopped counting after 50 losses, but it's over 50 losses.
I don't understand, like 50-1, what do they think is gonna happen come January, honestly?
Well, that's a great question. but I think there's a couple of potential answers. There's what do they want you to believe they think will happen, which is if you're a Trump fan, it's that they'll win. They are trying to assure their followers that this thing is gonna result in a win. Whether that is actually what they expect or even care about is a different question, because while all of this is going on, they are raising an ungodly sum of money. More than, far more, like 2 weeks ago, it was $200 million that they've raised supposedly for recounts and all of that. So win or lose, this is like a big money maker for them.
Oh, so why not? I get at this point. Fire up the next one.
Exactly. Well, yeah, and then that's why, like, you know, all the articles talking about Sidney Powell, they're like, this is the final lawsuit, and it's the final one that's pending, but this is going really well for her in terms of her social media following is blowing up and all of that. So why would she stop? And she's not, along the way, she's not gonna let stupid things like the fact that she's barely more of a lawyer than either you or I are stop her. So this is information that the judge focused on in the more than 40 page ruling. So just like your colleagues in, sorry, what were you saying?
No, I was just gonna say, like, I've seen Legally Blonde. I know a thing or two about the courtroom. Exactly. I'd say we're about equal.
I'm not sure that Sidney has actually seen that, but.
Oh, well, so, then she's not a real attorney. Disbarred.
No, disbarred. So Judge Pepper faced a lawsuit that was littered with baseless allegations and conspiracy theories, as well as typos and factual inaccuracies, which she pointed out. In a footnote to the judgment, Pepper pointed out that Powell had sought 48 hours worth of surveillance footage from the TCF Center, which is in Michigan, not in Wisconsin, so it doesn't have anything to do with this Wisconsin lawsuit. She also pointed out that Powell misspelled the name of her lead plaintiff, not a good sign. And finally, the judge highlighted the fact that the plaintiff appeared to have made up a quote purporting to come from a decision made by Pepper's own colleague, Judge Stadmuller. The quote simply doesn't exist. But with all of that and it being thrown out, one might wonder, how is Sidney Powell doing with all of this? Well, apparently she's doing okay, because after this ruling, she tweeted this. And we're not gonna show you the full video that's attached to her tweet, but it is a video of Michael Flynn, recently pardoned by the president, engaged in a gun battle with George Soros for some reason. So I guess she can't lose. Like, even when she loses, she can't lose. It's a good gig.
Why is it always Soros that's like their number one enemy whenever they make these really crappy kind of memes? It's just, it's always Soros. I don't know why.
I mean, if I'm being perfectly honest, it's because he's the most widely known Jewish liberalish billionaire. And for them, that is enough. Just, you know, reference the very rich Jewish individual and they will fill in the blanks for you. That's my honest read of it, honestly. It's just anti-Semitism.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool Mad Libs.
Anyway. Exactly. Well, that, at least for now, is it for Sidney Powell. We'll have to see how she bounces back from this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
To listen to Donald Trump, he still thinks that he's gonna be president after January 20th. But behind the scenes, some of the people closest to him, if not all that willingly, are indicating that they don't necessarily agree with his read of the future. And here I'm talking about Melania. Because apparently, according to CNN, while the president is busy figuring out how to stay in the White House, the first lady is determining what to put in storage, What goes to Trump's New York City digs? And what should be tagged for shipment to Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida? She's apparently spending her days overseeing shipments of personal items around the country. She's already picked out the patterns for the traditional China set each first lady leaves at the White House, and has reportedly hired the same interior decorator Trump had redecorate the White House residence to add a similar charm to Mar-a-Lago. But we shouldn't expect a becoming style memoir from this first lady. She's considering a photo-centric coffee table book about White House hospitality or her redesign projects, according to a source in the publishing industry. So Sabrina, there's a lot there. The most important, I think, headline is that Melania apparently does not believe that in February she's going to be first lady, which I think is important. Maybe that could get through to Trump.
No, absolutely, that's important. And honestly, like, when your lease is up and you're in a relationship like that, that is the best time to consider maybe moving a separate house. I don't know. So I'm sure she's just excited to get out of that house in the first place. I don't blame her. But yeah. I think that does provide some insight as to, you know, how January is going to go.
Well, yeah, you know, I haven't necessarily been thinking about that, but we do know that early on in his first term, when he was living in the White House, she spent an extended period of time still living in New York, you know, saying that it was for Barron's sake, something to a school or something like that. It is possible that if he goes to Mar-a-Lago, maybe she goes back to New York. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I will say, more importantly, I also don't care. Like, I do get schadenfreude from the idea. Anything that makes his life worse, okay, I'm going to get a bit of a chuckle out of that. But she's also really awful. And so it's not like she'll finally be free and she can live the life that she's always been waiting for. She stuck with this. She could have like left him or whatever when the kids were being caged or whenever, when he was about to go to war with Iran, but she stuck with him. Okay. And so whatever disdain we've been brewing, that should stick with us for her, I think.
No, anyway. I totally agree with you. I don't think she is excused at all.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? So in that little interview, the publishing industry source says that she's going to be writing like a coffee table book. Obviously, there are big shoes to step into from Michelle Obama, who has only become more popular, you know, in popular culture since no longer being first lady, with her doing Netflix stuff and her book was a bestseller for like 35 years. Do you think that Melania is feeling some pressure to try to like compare to that?
I mean, she could just do what she did before and rip a literal page out of her book.
Just publish like one chapter. This is my novella, baby.
I mean, a speech, a book, who's gonna notice? Oh, just exactly. Everybody.
Just everybody will check it, but I won't stop her. Nope. So according to a source that has been talking with Melania, she just wants to go home. Asked how the first lady feels about rumors her husband might announce a 2024 bid. The source added, quote, "That might not go over well." Yeah, this has been a big process. Trump doesn't want to leave the limelight, but it seems like Melania might be willing to do that. I wonder if that will cause added strain. If he does, because I don't know if you've seen this, Sabrina, but supposedly the rumor is that during the inauguration, Trump is going to launch his run. Like, he's not even going to wait until like the first week. He's going to do it day one and he's going to be running again. What are your thoughts about that? Do you think it's likely? Are you at all worried about him running again?
I mean, he could always like file to try, but I mean, in terms of like Melania's involvement with him, like, we're looking at 2024. Let's just see how 2021 goes. Mm-hmm. I think it's likely that maybe he could. I don't know. Yeah. What do you think?
I think it's likely. I think it is far more likely that he'll run.
Yeah.
Like, he'll be in the news. He'll call Fox and Friends or whatever. Will he actually be on the ballot running? That I think is less likely. This dude is aging, and 4 years in the future, I don't even know what's going to be left of me, let alone him. That is a long time in the future. He's going to be almost 80 years old. We'll have to see. Mm-hmm. One interesting bit of news, though, a lot of people have been speculating about what is going to happen to the White House after the Trumps have finally left. And the concerns really break down into two areas. One is that nobody wears masks. They don't seem to take this seriously. And of course, Trump and Melania both had COVID, as well as many of their aides and all of that. And then also the non-COVID related ew sort of vibe that you get from Donald Trump. Well, apparently According to news I saw this morning, Biden is going to have the entire White House east and west wings showered with disinfectant right after Trump leaves.
I mean, that's you should do that with anybody, but especially that house.
I think it is definitely due. I would do it even if I were moving right now. With Trump though, I mean, I'm just like, are they going to have to like broom out piles of Filet-O-Fish boxes? Like, I'm not even just worried about the COVID. Like, does anybody think that he is a clean person? I know it doesn't matter in comparison to so many other things that he's done, but Biden especially, like, jokes aside, Biden's an old guy. He's got to be incredibly worried about getting COVID. I really do hope that they take it as seriously as possible, because and it's not just him. Like, the White House is going to be full of a whole new crop of older people. I think disinfectant should be like stage one. Maybe some fire might have to get involved.
Do you think that Biden is going to like stay in the same room, like in terms of like living?
Would you?
Probably not.
I would feel deeply uncomfortable, I think. Yeah. I mean, it would be uncomfortable anyway, just the weight of history for how many people will have stayed in that bedroom. But I think I would want to give it at least a couple of months. I'm sure there's a lot of nice couches one could, you know, kick one's heels up on. There's probably a million guest bedrooms. I would explore the space before I committed to that individual room, I think.
Yeah, it's a good strategy.
Yeah, I think so. Ugh. Ugh. So apparently Rudy Giuliani has thus far survived his bout of COVID, which is of course good news. Don't wish bad news on anyone. But the follow-up question would be, has he learned anything from this experience? And the answer is a resounding, what are you, an idiot? No, of course he hasn't, you big dummy. So he tweeted, back 100% and lost little time, testifying at 11 a.m. before Georgia legislature on the additional live from Atlanta election theft tapes, no evidence of fraud. I don't get, like, is he taunting us that there's no evidence of fraud? Because that's what we've been trying to tell him, but he's still working. But anyway, he's still working, he's back at it. When asked if his experience being hospitalized has changed his views on masks, which he notably almost never wears, he said, no, it does not. I think you can overdo the masks. That's a good point. I think you can also possibly underdo it, you know, like when you got COVID. Like, you are the failure case for not wearing a mask. But Sabrina, it hasn't got through to him at all. Like, he's coming out like Trump, as virulently opposed to COVID safety measures as he was beforehand.
Well, I mean, like Trump, he has access to all of, you know, these like better like experimental medications that the regular Americans and just the rest of the world don't have access to. So why bother wearing a mask when you know these doctors have your back?
Exactly. Yeah. Like, and by the way, he really does allude to that thought process that you're saying there. And in this next quote, he says that politicians have taken masks and business closures too far. And he says that COVID-19 is now a treatable disease. That is an amazing thing to say about a thing that's still killing so many people. And we're going to get into those numbers. It is sort of a treatable disease for a certain type of person. And that certain type of person is probably not on either side of this camera that I'm talking into right now. He had this to say about his treatment. He says, my treatment by the nurses and staff at Georgetown MedStar Hospital was miraculous. I walked in with serious symptoms. I walked out better than ever. And he goes on to say this, and I think this is amazing. Doctors Beckett, Kumar, and Lehman led an all-star team. Yeah, but like, Giuliani, do you get that? Like, we don't get a team of doctors. We don't get to like be the stars of an episode of House when we get COVID. You do. You get that full team and around the clock coverage, as well as medications we'll talk about. But like, Sabrina, if you got COVID, would you expect that you have an all-star team of doctors, including from the White House as well?
Absolutely not. And honestly, I don't think even, who was it, Chris Christie? He didn't get like a team or anything either. So it's like, you gotta really be in that tight knit circle to get that sort of treatment.
Yeah, I mean, Christie, I was very worried when Chris Christie got sick that he would not survive, but he did. He did. Yay. Now, the thing about it is that it isn't just about the team. It's also, as you alluded to, that some people can get this special medicines that we, for a long time on the Damage Report, we've been talking about the monkey antibodies that Dr. Johnny Bananas dispatches to the truly elite. Rudy Giuliani, the latest member of President Trump's inner circle to contract COVID-19, has acknowledged that he received at least two of the same drugs the president received. He even conceded that his celebrity status had given him access to care that others did not have. He said, "If it wasn't me, I wouldn't have been put in a hospital, frankly. Sometimes when you're a celebrity, they're worried if something happens to you, they're going to examine it more carefully and they do everything right." I really hate his use of the word celebrity there. But anyway, yeah, that's sort of the thing. You got access to these medicines and we wouldn't. So maybe it's treatable for you. Look, if they can save Rudy Giuliani, a case could be made that if they really wanted to, they could save anybody. He is a 130-year-old half man, half bat who is rotting and farting his way to an early grave. But they saved him. But lots of people, thousands a day, don't get saved.
And I feel like even just by saying that, like what you said, his use of the word celebrity, like how does that not feel like an oligarchy when you just, you're mask off, I'm a celebrity, I got better treatment because of it. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you just expect it. It's just gonna happen. It's gonna happen for you. And let's give people an idea of what that might look like. What do you actually get access to? So this is, by the way, great write-up by New York Times. And I love that they're giving this update on Giuliani, but they're making very clear that this is once again a reminder of the massive class differences in healthcare access and affordability in America. They say that Mr. Giuliani's candid admission once again exposes that COVID-19 has become a disease of the haves and the have-nots. The treatment given to Mr. Trump's allies is raising alarms among medical ethicists as state officials and health system administrators grapple with gut-wrenching decisions about which patients get antibodies in a system that can only be described as rationing. The treatments, a monoclonal antibody developed by Eli Lilly and a cocktail of two monoclonal antibodies developed by Regeneron, won emergency use authorization from the FDA last month for outpatients with mild to moderate disease who are at high risk for progressing to severe disease or for being hospitalized. The treatment that President Trump got is certainly not available to all patients, and this has been confirmed by multiple doctors. So they make a big deal out of this, and Trump has talked about those medicines multiple times in press conferences since then, about how awesome it is and how he feels stronger than ever, and now he's immune. And that has led, I believe, many Americans to believe that that stuff is waiting for them. So they don't need to take this super seriously. Maybe they wear a mask, but they still go to Thanksgiving or something. But that stuff is not necessarily waiting for just anybody. You, like, if you're watching this, I wish you all the best in the world. You're awesome. But you're not the president's lawyer, and they're not gonna send you to Walter Reed, and they're not gonna give you the monkey meds, and they're not gonna do any of that. Like, you're gonna be stuck like every regular person, just having to roll the dice and hope that you get through this thing.
No, absolutely. And I think even some states like Utah, they either have like a ranking system on like who is the most deserving of these types of treatments, because you know it's so limited. And other states, I'm not sure which one, it might also be Utah, but they also have like a lottery system as to like who's gonna end up getting this treatment. And like it's not fair, and people should not expect or rely on it just because people like Trump or Rudy Giuliani highly recommend it. Not everybody even has access to it, and imagine how much it would even cost if they did have access to it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, he can afford it. He's getting paid $20,000 a day or whatever, but it would bankrupt any of us. No, I'm glad that you. I didn't know about the lottery system. Like,
yeah.
The fact that the doctors are having to make decisions about who gets the treatment and who doesn't, this is an experience that my family went through earlier this year, is bad enough. That's effectively a death panel, which Republicans, you know, fear-mongered about, but now they're totally fine with it. The fact that we have to triage for a disease that we've had for 10 months now, we still aren't ready to actually deal with it. That's bad enough. But I mean, the lottery, that's Hunger Games basically right there. And the president doesn't even have to talk about COVID anymore. He doesn't even engage with it.
And then have to do anything.
Yeah. Well, look, I want to transition to sort of the other side of this. So we're going to go from Rudy Giuliani, who's got the team of doctors, he's got the monkey antibodies, and he's got all of that. What about for the rest of us? I was going to talk about a particular story in the show today, because by itself, it's horrible. And it has to do with the fact that a Reno hospital has such an overflowing number of COVID patients that they had to convert one of their parking garages into effectively a hospital for him. That was why I was going to cover it. And then I started watching news coverage of this overflow capacity. And it got even worse than that. Take a look at this video. This is CNN talking with a doctor, Jacob Kieperman, about that hospital's emergency efforts.
Your worst day.
So my worst day this pandemic was actually the day I posted the tweet thanking my teammates. I had just finished a 7-day stretch in the intensive care unit. There had been patient after patient after patient who was not surviving this illness.
The tweet he sent was a simple selfie showing off their new COVID-19 wing. That wing set up in the hospital parking garage. That fact seemed to set President Trump off, who retweeted a tweet calling it fake and a scam. That unleashed the Twitter trolls.
I was sad and devastated, and I was angry.
Devastated and angry because all of the hard work being done by his colleagues inside this parking garage hospital every single day.
So yeah, I was gonna cover it because the idea that in America we would have to convert a parking structure, which is made for keeping your car there and maybe emergency urination, we're turning that into a hospital, was bad enough. But the fact that the president of the United States, who this might be the only engagement that he's had with the pandemic for several days, is to say that that is fake and it doesn't exist. That's just madness, Sabrina.
I just don't even understand why he would accuse that particular one of being fake. Like, if you were going to stage something, why would you choose like I'm assuming like a not very well ventilated parking garage, you know, like unless they absolutely had to. And so for, you know, as soon as Trump tweets about something like that, like of course the, you know, trolls and, you know, the firm believers in him are going to come after you, like that poor doctor.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the quick answer, why would he focus on that? Because he doesn't care. Like he retweets any random person. He doesn't care. Like, and we already know that there have been people, maskless people, who've been trying to like break into hospitals to show that all of these ICUs are empty because they believe that it doesn't actually exist. This is 100% inspiring more people to do that. Throwing gasoline on the fire of these conspiracy theories that the pandemic doesn't exist, people actually aren't hospitalized, the deaths are fake. And he's doing that. Well, look, just on the off chance that you wear a red hat and you're watching this right now, let's play a little bit more of the video so that you can see that it does actually exist. And then it goes to an even darker place.
And so here we are on floor G of the parking garage.
It was scary. You know, we don't expect to go to work and be working out of a parking garage. We've made it a hospital, so we don't even consider it a garage anymore.
Did you ever think that in America they would have to treat people in a parking lot?
I apologize for what I'm going to say. When they start building this, I laugh.
So really fast. So you can go see the full interview if you want. So that woman had been, you know, sort of involved in the transition to it being that, and thought that it was like a joke basically. So then she later got sick and she is now being treated in it. And then her husband got sick and he's 4 parking spaces down from her. They're both hospitalized with COVID. 4 parking spaces in America down, being treated for a fatal illness.
Yeah, I feel like it kills me. Some people just aren't going to care or take it seriously until, not even until they get it, but if they get it and their symptoms are actually bad. It's almost scary when some of those like non-believer people do get it and then they overcome it and then they're like, oh, well, it's not a big deal. Whatever, I'm not gonna wear a mask. I beat it once, it's fine. And it's like, okay, you're fine. I don't care about you. It's about the people who aren't going to be fine.
Exactly, yeah. And so that nurse that we showed, like they're dealing with these people who end up being hospitalized and still don't believe that it's real. And so you talked about the people that like are lucky enough to survive it, and then they sort of in their mind it's confirmed that it's not serious. Well, unfortunately, like that's Rudy Giuliani and that's Donald Trump. Yep. And that's all these boneheaded Republicans that were as protected as any human could be, but still didn't take it seriously. And so against all odds, they actually got the disease and now they believe that it's not a big deal. And so Trump has gone around the country doing these rallies, telling people that you get to survive it and they've got awesome antibodies and it'll be totally fine. Well, tell that to the 3,000 families a day that are losing people. And so with that, why don't we go to the numbers? Because I've been sort of dreading this number. Every day on the show, we give an update on what's happening with COVID. And so as of just yesterday, the most recent reporting from the COVID Tracking Project, there were 3,054 reported deaths in one day, the highest single day total to date. That is horrifying. Also horrifying are the 210,000 cases and the nearly 107,000 people currently sitting in hospitals, of which at least a few thousand are inevitably going to die. Our 7-day average for COVID-19 deaths are also now at an all-time high. Deaths have been rising throughout the country. The previous single day record was hundreds lower. And the way the cases are going, the way the hospitalizations are going, why would we look at this and believe that that's going to just be a blip? This December is going to be absolutely devastating and people still aren't really taking it that seriously.
Like COVID is literally worse right now than it was like when we first learned about it, at least especially in the US. And it seems like people are just so over it. They just don't care anymore. They're not even like reacting like a fraction as to how like they reacted, back in March.
Yeah, exactly. And on the show, we've done 1 billion segments about COVID, trying to get people to take it seriously, even though it doesn't seem to be working based on the numbers here. And then also, I see what videos of ours people watch and they mostly ignore the COVID stuff. So that's great, but we're gonna keep doing it no matter what. Here's an interesting visualization for the growth of COVID in recent time. Take a look at this as the number of cases per 100,000 individuals rises throughout the country. Yeah, that's from September to the beginning of December. That's not even up until today. It's been getting worse the past couple of weeks. They have to keep adding darker colors to these maps because otherwise they'd all just be the formerly darkest color. Over 3,000 deaths. If it sustains at 3,000, we're gonna lose more than 100,000 people by the time Joe Biden is the president. And like we were saying on the show yesterday, it's one thing for hundreds of thousands of people to die when we're just like hoping they'll develop a vaccine. But now we have it. We just have to survive to get it. And so many more people are gonna die between now and then. That hypothetical, like you could, if you're in a really high risk category, you might get it in the next 2 months. For people like me, or Sabrina's much younger, she's gonna have to wait longer than me. But even me, it's only gonna be like 4 more months of taking this seriously. And it's the rest of your life. But in the end, what is the total number of deaths gonna be between when we knew that we had a solution and when it was finally available to every individual? It's just terrifying.
And again, like the most powerful thing, like more powerful than the vaccine that you could do to prevent getting COVID, stay home. Don't congregate with groups of people, literally just stay home. I understand that some people do have to, work. And that's why for those of us who are able to stay home, who are, a little bit more non-essential, stay home. I don't understand. I'm happy that, we're finally instituting like harsher lockdowns. It's a little too late in my opinion, but I mean, it's better late than never. But yeah, until we do have, more widespread access to this vaccine, stay home.
Yeah. Oh God. By the way, one of the ways that we've tried to track how bad this pandemic has been is by comparing it to other disasters. So we're rapidly closing in on a 9/11 every day. That's great. We shot past, for instance, the total battle deaths from Vietnam. I believe we just passed World War I. I think that we're getting up there towards World War II. There's really only beyond this, it's the Civil War. And after that, there's nothing that compares historically to this. So we're running out of metaphors, America. Please stay home. Yesterday, Anna Kasparian and I were lucky enough to speak with Senator Bernie Sanders about the negotiations going on right now for the much needed aid the American people while the pandemic continues. And I wanted to talk about one part of it. And so to that end, here is one of the interactions I had with Senator Sanders in that interview yesterday. Senator, one thing that has been sometimes in the deal, sometimes apparently not in the deal. Yesterday, Mitch McConnell said that the corporate liability shield wouldn't necessarily need to be in there, but today it seems like it's back on the table. Is that the sort of thing that will be or should be a deal breaker either for you or for other Democrats in terms of supporting this final bill? I think it's
one of the things. The direct payment is also for me a deal breaker. This is a total outrage. You have had major corporate interest often in the food processing business, the meat processing business, who have treated their workers in the most irresponsible manner, where hundreds of workers have become ill, some have died. You have seen in Amazon some 20,000 workers who have been infected. We don't know how many have died. If you give them a green light, and if you say, no problem, you don't have to take any responsibility for your treatment of workers and the safety provisions or lack of safety provisions that you have provided, what you're saying to every corporate interest in America, you can do anything you want. And there is impunity. And that is an outrage which must not be allowed to happen.
And so as of right now, Sabrina, those negotiations are still going on. We don't know for sure exactly what's going to happen. But according to draft Republican plans that the Business Insider got, they're looking for potentially to stop corporations and universities and stuff too. They add that on, although I don't think they really care about that part. They care about the corporations. They're gonna be protected from lawsuits retroactively. So like even what after this passes, lawsuits that had been already launched this month will be invalidated. And for potentially up to 5 years, corporations that have slacked off on safety standards, forced their employees to come back at, even though it's not safe with the threat of firing, they can be protected from lawsuits for half a decade, apparently.
I don't understand how they managed to like slip this in and how by default, everybody just doesn't see it as evil. That's so evil. So many people have died at this point, and it is because of, negligent employers. And so the fact that like this is what the Democrats have to negotiate with is disturbing. And I'm worried because like even now Bernie Sanders is advocating for, that 1,200 check, right? When, at the top of the pandemic, he was talking about like $2,000. So even he has, dropped, he's lowered his bar. And the thing is, he is one of the most left voices that we have out there. And when it comes to like more of the typical Democratic representative, it just seems like since they have moved a little bit more right, it seems like that negotiation starts closer to the right. And so that's why we're seeing such awful offers. Like we're already starting from such a compromised position instead of if we had, a little bit more left voices, we could, start from somewhere a little bit more reasonable.
That's a great point. I'm glad that you mentioned that. Yeah, that even Bernie Sanders is asking for less. And let's bear in mind, at one point early on in the pandemic, there were some people talking about recurring payments of $1,000 to $2,000 every month. We are like miles away from that. And isn't it amazing that we're miles away from that after all of our worst fears about how bad the pandemic would be were proven true? Like it's as bad as we worried that it would be. We're racing towards a third of a million Americans dead. And the Democrats won the GD election. But despite all of that, we're now talking about getting less than we were back then. It's weird how American politics works. That doesn't seem like how it should work.
Yeah, it seems like vote blue, no matter who, wasn't the solution that it was portrayed that it was going to be.
Yeah, I still think it's better than the alternative, but it doesn't.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not saying vote for Republicans at all. That is not what I'm saying. But I think it does matter who, when choosing the blue.
Breaking news: Sabrina supports Mitch McConnell. Anyway. Now, thankfully, in addition to Bernie Sanders, though, there are some who are at least pushing for But the stimulus checks, which again, I hate the term stimulus checks. We talked about that with Bernie as well. That's not what they are. It's not about stimulating the economy. It's about saving lives and saving people's livelihoods, but also stopping this liability from being a part of this. Representative Katie Porter, who we talk about often on the show, she had a tweet chain about this corporate liability being such a big part of this, saying these lawsuits represent the worst of the worst examples of disregard for human life. Cases filed on behalf of nursing home patients and grocery store workers who died because the company in charge of keeping them safe prioritized cutting costs over protecting them. The same McConnell who said that President Trump is 100% within his rights to pursue baseless lawsuits alleging election fraud is now refusing to pass urgently needed relief unless it strips those same rights from the most vulnerable among us. This must be exposed. And I love that Katie Porter is talking about that. I think she's going places. That's a bold prediction that no one else has. But anyway, the idea that this has to be a part of this, that we can't get money to people before they're thrown out of their apartments to save them without this being a part of it, I think is madness, especially when, just briefly, as we talked about on the show yesterday, we are right now getting lawsuits having to do with the immediate effects of the pandemic. Family members of those who have died because of corporate negligence and things like that. Maybe people who have, they're trying to get money for their hospital stay that already happened. But the thing is, we don't yet know about the long-term effects. There are people who are going to need medical care for the rest of their lives, and that could generate lawsuits as well. But we don't even know yet. We don't even have had the, we haven't had the time yet to generate those sorts of studies for class action lawsuits to spring up. And that seems to me to be the reason that they're looking to ram this in as fast as possible to stop those things from ever getting off the ground, as they have in some other cases of long-term lingering damage yielding lawsuits.
And that's the thing, they know they were in the wrong. They know that they've made grave mistakes. They're just looking to minimize the consequences for them now at this point.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. Now, Bernie said that it should be a bridge too far. We'll see in the end how many Democratic senators agree with that. I have a feeling no Republicans will, but we'll see. And earlier this week, Mitch McConnell had said that the liability shield didn't necessarily have to be in there. He seems to have moved on from that brief position that he held. So I guess we'll have to see. The terms of the deal seem to change every single day. Now, with that said, let's move on. Yes, we are running low on time, so we're gonna jump right into this. A bit of an uncomfortable story about Dianne Feinstein just yesterday on New Yorker, but we do have to engage with it, because as our average elected official, especially in the Senate, gets older and older, the sort of concerns that this expose are talking about are not going to be limited to just one or two representatives. So apparently, there have been some concerns raised by former Feinstein aides about her cognitive situation. Apparently, back when she, on November 17th, was grilling a witness, reading from a sheaf of prepared papers, she asked Jack Dorsey whether his company was doing enough to stem the spread of disinformation. He apparently answered the question, and then she asked him the same exact question, word for word, with the same sort of related Trump tweet. And he answered it again, but it certainly stood out to people as a weird situation to have happened. There was no reason to read it again. But some of these aides are saying that she has been briefed on topics, but then immediately forgets about them. They describe her as forgetting what she has already said and getting angry when she's called out for forgetting things. And look, I've had family members who have dealt with these sorts of age-related memory issues, and that is a thing that definitely happens. Now, they do say that sometimes she seems herself, and at other times she's unreachable. Quote, the staff is in such a bad position, one former Senate aide said. They have to defend her and make her seem normal. So we're gonna talk a little bit more about how this has affected some particular recent bits of politics, including the Amy Coney Barrett nomination. But Sabrina, how do you think that people are gonna respond to this information that a sort of senior senator that a lot of centrist respect is sort of having trouble just doing her duties?
I don't think people are gonna look that much into it. I mean, especially, I know that there were even like questions in regards to like Joe Biden's cognitive ability, and that kind of got brushed over. And, you know, Diane, she, you know, has been a trailblazer to a lot of people, especially centrists over the years. And so I feel like people will try to change that conversation to, well, maybe you're just being ageist or maybe you're just being sexist, as opposed to answering, you know, maybe she should have some sort of cognitive ability test, have her draw a clock. Just to make sure that, you know, she is still sharp. I mean, she is 87. Most people would have retired well over 10 plus years ago. And we've seen what happens when, you know, politicians stay in power a little too long. And if they happen to either get sick in office or they die in office, it leaves us in a really vulnerable position.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, she ran for re-election just a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. She's free to do that, I guess. She didn't have to do that. We have this idea that just like once you get in there, man, you just go the rest of your life. It doesn't have to be that way. And there are like, it's not necessarily ageism to feel that, you know, someone who, you know, sort of came into politics in the Reagan years, pre-Reagan years, might not necessarily fully understand the concerns of later generations. I mean, we all remember her interaction with Sunrise Movement activists just a couple of years ago. Is it possible that the cognitive stuff played into that? I don't know, but I didn't like it either way. And in any event, it is having recent effects. And this isn't according to me. I'm just, you know, I'm an a-hole online. That's all I am. But these are people who actually work with her. So remember, she's the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, which has been sort of important considering that Donald Trump has gotten 3 Supreme Court justices over the past few years. As the ranking Democrat, Feinstein ordinarily would be expected to run the party's strategy on issues of major national importance, including those nominations. Instead, the committee has been hamstrung and disorganized. One aide said other members were constantly trying to go around her because as chair, she didn't want to do anything and she also didn't want them doing anything. One said she's an incredibly effective human being, but there's definitely been some deterioration in the last year. She's in a very different mode now. People point to the fact that we had to wait a long time into the Kavanaugh hearing process before finding out about the Christine Blasey Ford allegations, and apparently Feinstein had been sitting on them. Now, is that memory related? I don't know, but it was definitely bizarre and possibly very consequential. And apparently, according to several sources, Chuck Schumer, Democratic Minority Leader, was so worried that Feinstein would mismanage Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearings that he installed a trusted former aide, Max Young, to embed in the Judiciary Committee to make sure the hearings didn't go off the rails. He had done the same thing during Kavanaugh's confirmation as well. Schumer brought Young in from the gun control group Everytown to handle strategy and communications and serve as Schumer's eyes and ears on Feinstein, according to one Senate source. You should not need to have eyes and ears for the ranking member. They're supposed to be there because they have experience and they'll be effective. And that really seems to have been turned on its head in Democratic leadership over the past few years.
No, absolutely. If you need like a babysitter at that point, you should consider stepping down.
I think so. Schumer apparently also has had several serious and painful talks with Feinstein, according to a well-informed source. Overtures were also made to enlist the help of her husband. Feinstein, meanwhile, was apparently surprised and upset by Schumer's message. Compounding the problem, Feinstein seemed to forget about the conversation soon after they talked, so Schumer had to confront her again. One source said it was like Groundhog Day, but with the pain fresh each time. Anyone who's tried to take the car keys away from an elderly relative knows how hard it can be, this aide said. It wasn't just about a car, it was about the US Senate. So look, I get that this is going to be uncomfortable for a lot of people, especially people who have a strong attachment to Dianne Feinstein. And I understand that any sort of conversation like this is going to feel to a lot of people like a form of ageism. But I would just say, this is not just some honorary position or something where it's nice for them to still be able to do this. This is one of the 100 most powerful people in the world in an incredibly important time, serving from a state that has a Democratic governor. So it's not even like stepping down prematurely would result in a Republican or anything like that. You could get a Senator Katie Porter as a result of her stepping down, or Ro Khanna, or Karen Bass, or Barbara Lee, or take your pick. These are all options. And so the fact that this is coming out at all and that so many people were willing to at least anonymously go on the record, this could potentially become a big issue. And I would argue that based on what they're saying, it probably deserves to.
No, I totally agree with you. California, your seat is going to be safe if that's what you're worried about.
Mm-hmm. I agree. This pandemic has been a time of creativity with everybody trying to fill up their time that they can't, you know, do normal stuff with coming up with ideas. Some of them great. And then there are others. So I want you to take a look at something that's being advertised on TikTok that I saw on the Twitter account of Taylor Lorenz. Here is the slap mask.
Had a $1 million idea for a mask that slaps on your wrist. So I called my buddy Nick, who runs a manufacturing company in LA, and we hopped on a flight. Within a week, our friend Avery created the prototype. People loved it. Everybody wanted one. So Nick filed a patent and ordered 20,000 units that we're releasing today. If you want one, click the link in my bio before they're gone.
Guy on the hoverboard. Why is he on a hoverboard? There's no reason to. You're on a business call. Get off the hoverboard. Anyway, I have a lot of thoughts, but Sabrina, I'll let you go first. What do you think about the slap mask?
That is one of the broiest infomercials I've seen since mm-hmm. the male romper. Like, yeah. his buddy in LA talking on a hoverboard on speakerphone. Come on. But also, number one, ew. You're gonna be putting that mask on and off after it's been like on your wrist, where you know you're doing most stuff with your hands and going in and out, touching stuff. Like, you shouldn't be touching your mask that much anyway if you're out and about doing stuff. Ugh.
Yeah, look, I get your concern, but I like the versatility. I like that it's a transformer. So I'm actually developing a mask that turns into a pair of bikini bottoms. I guess it'll be popular. We're gonna come out with something for men too. No, it's just okay. Look, I wanna acknowledge one thing. I really checked very carefully to make sure that this isn't a joke, because if it's a joke, it's funny. But everybody swears it's real. So okay, I guess it's real. They're trying to make something that theoretically will result in more people wearing masks. So to that extent, I am glad that you have come up with this invention. But that's it. Beyond that, it's not like you can't be putting it on your hand and then you're gonna put the bacteria from your hand back on your face. And like, why not just leave it on? There's a reason there's loops. If you have to put it down and just let it hang, you can do that. Or you can put it in your pocket. You don't have to put it on your dirty, dirty skin. I just don't get it.
Yeah, you're gonna have to use your other hand to, you know, slap it on your face too. Like, that's so gross. The whole point is to touch it as little as possible. That's why it can just hang off of your face.
And it's the sort of thing where it's like, I wasn't there when they had the first conversation, but everybody knows exactly what it looked like. And it must have been like, hey, you remember those slap bands from when we were kids? That would be cool. And like, we'll be able to make a cool video and a guy will be on a hoverboard. I get that. And I'm sure that they thought they'll make a lot of money. And by the way, they're probably gonna make a ton of money.
Oh, yeah.
But these aren't doctors, and they don't seem to have talked to doctors.
Who knows? I honestly just think that science has just gone too far on this one. Yeah.
And the thing that bothers me even more, and I don't know, if you diligently watch the show, every once in a while I will talk about these inventions in Silicon Valley and the way that startups work. Why does every random idea that someone who is in a frat have generate $10 million in investment income instantly? Like, I just don't get it. Like, why is so much of the American economy based on like the guy that I used to play Flip Cup with is now in charge of this company? Put the investments into actual PPE. Like, you could make that more available.
I'm sure that, you know, their father is just happy to invest because they're doing something.
Mm-hmm,
they're doing anything.
And look, if you're watching this and invented this, I know that we're being really hard on you. Again, I'm glad that you're doing something mask related or whatever.
That's nice.
And it's been a tough year. I get that. And by the way, we just gave you free advertising, so don't be so hard on us. But just come on, man. Like, there's thinking, and then there's thinking a little bit more. And thinking a little bit more is almost always going to be better. Anyway. Well, Sabrina, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of The Damage Report. Where can people see more of your fabulous work?
Well, thank you so much for having me, John. People, you can find me on youtube.com/AvelinaSabrina. Same thing on twitch.tv/AvelinaSabrina.
Awesome. Sounds good. Thank you again, and stay safe out there. as Joe Biden has been choosing who is going to, at least assuming they can get through a possibly Republican Senate, fill his cabinet, I've been waiting to see, is he going to choose progressives for important positions? He's going to choose people that I have a good knowledge of their track record so that I can evaluate what effect they're likely to have on his administration. Well, there's one that is both going to be very important and I actually am looking to learn a lot more about, and that is Biden's pick to be the new Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. And joining us now to break down what this might mean for the Biden foreign policy is Democratic strategist and contributor to both the Daily Beast and the New York Daily News, Max Burns. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. You did a write-up about Antony Blinken. So for someone who might not have followed Blinken's career, who is this individual?
Yeah, Antony Blinken is a name that I think surprised a lot of people. A lot of pundits are having to furiously Google and Wikipedia who this guy is. Blinken served as the deputy national security advisor under President Barack Obama, and then spent 2 years as deputy secretary of state. And he really got the reputation within the Obama administration of someone who could work with a lot of cliques and a lot of different factions within the foreign policy community, and who also was really respected overseas as being a really honest collaborator with foreign governments. You can sort of trust that when Tony Blinken is pursuing policy, that he's speaking for the administration, which would be a nice change from what we have now, which is a Secretary of State pursuing foreign policy that sometimes the same day is contradicted by the president. And that's the sort of security that the world's really looking for right now.
Okay, so that's interesting. So look, to the extent that one can train for the job, arguably he was sort of doing that under the Obama administration. In the time since then though, I mean, it hasn't been too many years, but the American place in the world is slightly different. Some foreign governments are now run by different people and our relationships with them are a bit different. So how different of a world is this for Antony Blinken? I mean, you're gonna have Biden, who obviously was there as well. That's a sort of source of consistency. But those cliques that you talked about in American foreign policy in that world, like is he basically entering back into the world that he last left, or has too much changed since then?
This is almost a post-apocalyptic movie. I mean, if you wanted a challenge, restoring American foreign policy is about the biggest challenge you could take on. And it's something that Joe Biden has been focused on his entire career. It's something very important to him. Like, for example, we've lost 5,000 career diplomats since the end of the Obama years. 300 of them have left just in the past 6 months. And the Trump administration's own inspector general released a report a few months ago that said staff shortages, frequent turnover, poor leadership, and inexperienced staff are jeopardizing the State Department's ability to carry out its role. So we've gone from, in 2009, a State Department that was very effective and built into a useful force for pursuing international consensus, to in 2020, a State Department that is barely competent to do its own internal job. And that kind of morale drop, that kind of staff loss needs to be addressed before a President Biden can hope at all to go out into the world and start fixing these problems. Because we quite frankly just don't have the staff or the expertise to do what the State Department used to do.
Yeah, and look, my hope, I guess, would be at least for some of those sort of the middle tier bureaucrats who've fled in such numbers, hopefully they still have their phone numbers and they can arguably go back in those positions. But so when I'm trying to figure out what some of these cabinet choices mean for what Biden plans to do, so we've got Blinken potentially in state, you've got this former General Austin as Secretary of Defense. When we're trying to figure out what is the Biden predisposition towards like foreign conflicts or big diplomatic overtures like the Iran nuclear accords or the Paris climate accords, what Blinken specifically, what do we know about what he's supported and opposed in the past that might tie into any of those things?
So a lot of Antony Blinken's work has been behind the scenes. He was involved, of course, in the Paris climate accords. He was involved in the Iran nuclear deal. And with these appointments with the Secretary of Defense, with appointments at NSA and the UN, Joe Biden's really sending the message that these are steady hands. There's very few new faces in Joe Biden's foreign policy outfit. These are people who have either pre-existing relationships with foreign governments or have been very closely involved as experts in their fields for years. And this is something like with Anthony Blinken, who's very interested in refugees and in refugee resettlement. Something that is almost readdressing the problems that the Trump administration has ignored for 4 years. And it's people who we won't be expecting to see things in the news about the shocking things they said or the wild ideas they've proposed. These are all going to be very carefully vetted because very little in foreign policy, I anticipate, will be done without Joe Biden's signature on it. So it's going to be a very moderating force and not nearly the reality TV experience we've had under Trump.
You know, it's interesting because that sort of philosophy of choosing people is what I probably would have predicted for Joe Biden. But in your article, which is available on The Hill, you say that at least in one way, he's defied expectations by choosing Blinken. How is that exactly?
So the president-elect has really defied these expectations because we wanted to see, I think pundits wanted to see in some sense of Susan Rice. There was talk about Pete Buttigieg, about elevating a real political star into this role. Someone who could go out and have name recognition and conduct foreign policy. But a lot of evidence we've seen from Joe Biden is that that's not what he wants. That Joe Biden is looking to make some signature foreign policy victories in his term. That he wants to essentially have not so much the credit, but to have crafted it in his own image of foreign policy. And that he doesn't necessarily want to be balancing against someone who's also a potential 2024 presidential contender and could use the restructuring of foreign policy as a ground to shake up the race. We're really looking for pragmatic operators and not necessarily political stars.
Okay. Yeah, at this point I don't anticipate voting for President Blinken anytime soon. So far, based how what has the response been like from some of our allies and our adversaries to this potential pick? Do they seem to be down for Blinken?
I think everyone is breathing a sigh of relief here, as we all saw Mike Pompeo, the current Secretary of State, went on a sort of farewell tour to Israel, to Turkey, to France. And did very little actual diplomacy. It was almost all stage setting for what people expect to be Pompeo's 2024 campaign for president. What's going to be exciting, I think, especially for our European allies, is having someone who speaks their language quite literally, who understands the policy discussions and takes it seriously. We're going to go from an administration that can't even show up to G8 meetings on COVID and on Iran, to an administration that made those national priorities 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a very relaxing, in a sense, time to conduct diplomacy, because at least we'll know what to expect.
Interesting. And we appreciate you filling us in so that we know what to expect. If you're watching this, you'd like more information, Max's article is available on The Hill titled, "Can Anthony Blinken Make American Foreign Policy Great Again?" Great title there, by the way. Max Burns, as always, we appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.